Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are all back. Not only are we all back on Bombshell, we are all back on the Eastern time zone, which is really exciting. Before we're going to give you guys a little bit of a summer update, but before we start, ladies, what are we drinking?
I'm drinking yesterday's coffee, but iced. It's iced. It's iced, and you do this now too.
I don't do it with yesterday's coffee.
Okay, fair. Yesterday's coffee, but iced, and then I added some Frangelico to it. So it's quite tasty.
Mm-hmm.
I was drinking today's but morning coffee, so many hours old, but then I proceeded to spill it all over everything, including my notes. So I decided to solve the problem of that by switching to a nice sparkling rosé.
Very nice.
That sounds perfection. I had my coffee a little bit earlier, and I've been trying. We'll get to this, but I can't have too much coffee in the morning because I have too much asthma medicine in the morning. And so that combination is problematic. So I've now switched to just a small amount of gin with some passion fruit LaCroix, which really is my favorite mixer at the moment. So.
I will say, so I bought this rosé that I thought was terrible called Lillette, which it turns out is actually a Francy French rosé aperitif, which is terrible if you drink it straight. But if you mix it with either passion fruit or grapefruit LaCroix and a little bit of lime and some berries, it's fantastic, and I highly recommend.
Well, aren't we all just living our best lives at the moment? So it's been, I think, Radha, you and I have both, well, I've missed two episodes. I haven't been around for a little while, and that's because I spent a month at my sister's house with my nieces living in the attic, which was actually incredibly fun. My nieces came up with this story about their crazy aunt living in the attic, and it was not very fictionalized. It was pretty true to form. And then I tried to go to Colorado for a while and ended up with severe altitude sickness and pneumonia, which is a super great way to spend your summer vacation. But not COVID. So exactly right. But it turns out it still feels like an elephant sitting on your chest.
Yeah,
so
terrible.
I made it back to DC a couple weekends ago. Or maybe 1 week. We still don't really know how time works, but I've been recovering from that and putting my apartment back together and researching Bombshell things. So, and you did some traveling as well, Radha.
I did. We traversed the United States in our trusty Jeep with two small children and a dog. It was quite the adventure, though I actually think, frankly, after doing 5 months of exactly the same thing sitting in my basement, it was not as bad as I thought, and it was nice to just do something different. But I've actually gotten quite a few questions about, like, sort of tips and suggestions. Seems a lot of people are looking at getting closer to family as we did moving back to New York. So I am in the process of writing up, I don't know, Twitter or Medium post or something on tips and tricks for tracking the data and figuring out how to travel across the country in the middle of a pandemic with two small children.
It's interesting. One of the things that I noticed most was that when I was, for the few days that I was in Colorado, Colorado opened fairly early, but with really strict masking protocols. Yeah. And so people are out and about more, but with much higher compliance with masking regulations. And so you don't see, and it's all tied, at least where I was in Summit County, tied to, hey, if y'all want an economy, if y'all want, tourists and these mountain resorts to still be open, even in summer, you've got to, participate in the mask requirements. And so that was interesting to see, having been in Kansas and Missouri the previous, week or so or month, and definitely a different vibe coming from there.
Same. We thought, like, comparing the University of Colorado Boulder campus, where my husband went, to Notre Dame, where he also went, at Boulder, it was empty, and anyone you saw was socially distanced and masked, but people were out and about in Boulder, and the restaurants had a whole outdoor life. They've closed down streets, mm-hmm. and Indiana was open, but hey, there's no pandemic here, kind of open, which is a very stressful way to operate if you, think there is a pandemic happening.
And Lauren, you've mostly been hunkered down here in DC, but with some day trips. So you've got the day trip or weekend trip catalog for us.
Oh yeah. So we have, as you said, we've been staying here in DC. My big change this summer was starting a new job at a place where I have never seen my new office. I have never met anyone who reports to me. I have met my boss, but before he was interviewing me in any way. And this has just become the normal that you deal with. So we've done in terms of more fun things, we've done day trips to the beach, we've done tubing, we've been to Harper's Ferry, we've gone fishing, we do bike rides. So in some ways, it's actually kind of great in terms of forcing us to like think through what is fun that didn't involve being inside a museum or a bar or a restaurant or something like that, and being more creative in terms of what we do as a family. And in other ways, Ryan would censor this. I freaking hate my house. I just want out of my house. Like, my house is great, to be clear. I just, like, I have done every single home improvement project I can think of. I'm now at the point of, like, getting new throw pillows, which I do not need. I just need it to be different.
You asked the other day, Lauren, for people's like quarantine, you know, indulgences or whatever, or their binge watches. And one that my mother got me hooked on is Hometown on HGTV, which has like the most fantastic, like rundown craftsman houses that they all restore. And it's a couple who does it. And she has some like amazing, like crafty DIY stuff. And I'm like, oh, I wish I was that like thoughtful, creative, and patient. Instead, I would totally just buy that for $200 off Anthropology. So trying to find time for good crafts is a, you know, maybe a silver lining here. So anyway, well, we all have our beverages. We all are in our respective home studios-ish. And now we should talk about all the things going on in the world since the last time we got together. You ready?
I guess.
Shall we keep up some foreign relations? Okay, so the big news of last week, or at least one of the big news of the week in non-COVID-related matters, was the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, gave a big speech at the Nixon Library on U.S. policy toward China. And it was kind of a doozy. I don't know. Did you guys have a chance to look at this or read this, Radha? What was your kind of, you know, what's our initial assessment here?
So just taking a step back, I think this administration has obviously had a real, let's call it reset approach to China. And so a lot of that, you know, in terms of trade war, and then sort of in the context of COVID and sort of general pushback on immigration of Chinese nationals, especially students, has all really brought this to a head. And I think some of this has been more subtly done and some of this has been less subtly done. And I think the Pompeo speech fits squarely in the latter category.
Yeah, there's nothing subtle about the Pompeo speech.
So I think that context is important because there is sort of complexity with the relationship with China, right? And we do need to have pushback. We do want to worry about potential like insider threats from and IP concerns and national security concerns. And those are not made up. There's a kernel of truth there. With that context, the Pompeo speech provides none of that nuance and was basically a tremendous amount of bluster that essentially elided over the complexity and painted China as the big bad wolf in every possible dimension, which I think sort of feels to me like fundamentally unhelpful.
So one of the things that I hadn't realized, mostly because I've been fairly checked out of day-to-day news, is that this was the fourth in a series of speeches from the administration, which sounds incredibly coordinated and strategic for a group that's usually struggled on the interagency process. So we've had comments from the FBI director. We've had comments from the National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien. We've had comments from the Attorney General, all focusing on these issues that you mentioned here, Radha, including intellectual property and counterintelligence and a variety of things that sort of highlight the ways in which China, through a variety of different actors, is acting in an adversarial manner. And again, I think that that's, like, I agree with you, Radha, important to document and to reflect on. In many ways, Pompeo's speech reminded me of like a really bad affirmative case. You probably you debate the China topic in high school.
I think
you
were.
Yeah. So I still sometimes think about these things in those ways. And, you know, so basically he presents a list of harms, right? Like things that are problematic in the status quo, but then sets up a real straw man as the solution. And in fact, has no real policy prescriptions.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the writing, whether it's Richard Haass or Tom Wright or others, has highlighted that there's very little consistency across the administration that if you accepted all of these harms, the way in which China is undermining the international order, American national security, economic agreements, all these sorts of things, then you would be behaving very differently toward South Korea, Japan, Europe, and other allies. And so on the, you know, Pompeo had this one phrase that I thought was really interesting in the speech, which many people have picked up on, which is, what do the American people have to show now 50 years on from our engagement with China? And his answer is basically nothing. And I think there's a lot of cold warriors who would disagree, because that engagement with China was about boxing out the Soviet Union and exacerbating the Sino-Soviet shift or split. But also, I mean, there's been an incredible amount of mutual economic gain between the United States and China. Right. And to deny that, I think, is to misunderstand, you know, to say nothing of like the South Korean economic miracle or the mm-hmm. other East Asian tigers, all of which came up with Chinese economic growth. So it is this sort of, you're exactly right, Radha, that this nuance gets lost. But I do think then it just continues to beg the question of what should the foreign policy toward China be? And right. what should be the broader approach?
You bring up an interesting issue that every administration faces, and that making speeches about foreign policy issues is often quite boring. And like, if you're trying to make a speech that like talks about your various policy prescriptions, like it's usually not the most interesting thing on the planet. And as a result, when you make foreign policy speeches, quite often you're just making shit up. So you have the issue of presidents and their cabinets who will do foreign policy speeches that have very, very little to do with the actual policy reality that they're implementing. President Obama did this, past presidents did this. This is not new. What is slightly new in this instance is that China is very capable of listening to these speeches and responding in kind to the rhetoric with their own policy actions in a way that is harmful to United States interests, in a way that the United States is not doing coordinated policy as against China, to your point, Aaron, of like, we're doing some things ineptly and harshly, but we don't have a comprehensive strategy. Not that China is like all that great at this, but like they can listen and think through what is it we're able to and capable of responding in some way. The other point I think that is interesting on this is that it makes you wonder who exactly is coordinating this China policy for the United States, because there is a lot of inconsistency in terms of how the president talks about China. You have a deputy national security advisor who is an ostensible Asia expert, but it's tough to say if this reflects his own views and if he is behind the scenes running a policy process supporting this or being totally ignored. And there's not and I guess there's Peter Navarro, I would say, maybe, who is sort of the behind the scenes thought leader, strong term, who is driving this, but
certainly right, influential.
Certainly influential. Right. Yeah. I mean, Pompeo seems to have the goal of irreparably damaging or shifting U.S.-China relations in a way that a new administration could not come in and readjust in some way, at least not easily. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting, from a just a tactics perspective, it's an interesting thing to watch. I just don't know how effective they'll be.
And I think, like, sort of keying off that a little bit, remember early in the administration, I've been reflecting a lot on things we said in the early days and how they're basically exactly the thing I would say now. But remember how we were like, oh, foreign policy is supposed to be like a duck where it's like smoothly gliding on the water underneath. And this is kind of like an upside down duck and eventually going to drown because we see all the flailing around the top. I think that's a little bit of what's happening here, in the sense that you just essentially see multiple China policies externally sort of playing out real life. And I think a key consequence of that, like lack of coordination and lack of sort of top line consistent talking points, is that China gets a view into internal cleavages in U.S. foreign policy, very, as does everyone, and has ways to exploit them. So I think Phil Gordon has a nice piece of War on the Rocks on this sort of ongoing China-Iran deal on sort of trade and how that intersects with the U.S.'s, I mean, really ineffective trade war with China, effective in like costing the U.S. tremendous amounts of money and imposing some costs on China, but ineffective in that the way it was executed even has illustrated ways that China can leverage other relationships, other engagements with other strategic actors like Iran to undermine broader U.S. interests. And I think that's sort of playing out in multiple dimensions now, Iran being an example. I think, frankly, we'll see it playing out in terms of high-tech students and high-tech workers, which are sort of a key area where, yes, there are risks there, and those risks are not minimal, but painting it as if that is the majority problem instead of a one-off problem and trying to find the needles in the haystack really undermines both the approaches we need to successfully deal with it, and frankly, probably dissuades people from wanting to come here, which is totally reasonable, and probably not just Chinese, right? And so I think a lot of these follow-on consequences are ones that will bear for a long time, and that even without significant policy changes, the rhetoric does a lot to drive other actors to behave in ways that fundamentally undermine core U.S. interests.
And I think this does get back to some core questions. I mean, there's an element of reading Pompeo's speech, again, kind of in the harms section, you know, in the front end, where you're like, oh, they're going to announce a human rights-based policy toward China, right? The violations against the Uyghurs have got, I mean, the evidence there is basically irrefutable. The actions in Hong Kong, the, you know, and elsewhere, the human rights violations are really quite substantial. And then you see, no, they're not actually announcing that. And also this administration would be pretty low on the list of advocates for a human rights-based foreign policy, given how we've acted toward, you know, Saudi Arabia or Turkey or other, you know, sorts of places.
Even given Trump's responses to Xi himself.
Exactly.
You know, like, I mean,
in the Bolton book and elsewhere. So, you know, it does, one of the things that does come through in the Pompeo speech, and I think it's interesting, but mostly because it harkens back to a set of debates in the Cold War, which I find interesting, but maybe aren't, which is like, is China an unusual regime? You know, are they really acting outside of the bounds? Are they particularly ideologically motivated? And that the role of ideology seemed to play a big place, occupied a big place in the Pompeo speech as to why everyone should recognize that this was like a uniquely disruptive, you know, regime. And that's similar language that was used about the Soviet Union in many ways as well. I mean, that's really harkens back to the X memo and whatnot, Telegram. I tend to think of China as less ideologically and much more of a, like, this is a, whether you want to see them as a rising power or a local hegemon or, you know, in some other way, behaving fairly rationally given their domestic constraints, which we often overlook, and their foreign policy ambitions, which I think are fairly regionalized, and which is not to discount them or to discount their impact on the United States, or in particular our allies. But I don't find it particularly helpful analytically to see them as, you know, the boogeyman, right? And to try to paint them into an ideological corner that they're uniquely Marxist, or that the, you know, you hear this administration often refer to the Chinese Communist Party as a way of kind of making pointed remarks about the regime. And I mean, I get why they do that from a rhetorical perspective, and I do think that it's effective, but I don't think that it's necessarily helpful. And so I do, you know, there's going to be a lot, I mean, this will be in some ways the second foreign policy challenge, you know, of our time, you know, having done whatever it is we did with the war on terror. And it's now we're back to figuring out, I mean, how do you actually manage a long-term competitive relationship with more or less, at least an economic peer, if not quite yet a military peer, under terms of globalization? I mean, that's the question. And it's not, the answers aren't found in the Cold War. And I don't think we have, you know, the framework or certainly the rhetoric in this administration to address that.
So
that was awesome. let's move on to something else that has a lot more hope and positive metrics and a better story to tell, like the global COVID crisis.
Yeah. So I don't know how much you guys have been looking at global COVID maps and trends and data, but I spend a considerable amount of my time looking at these. And, you know, I thought it was worth having a discussion here on the resurgence or coming resurgence in active continued surge in countries that fail to stem it, in part because I think it probably has a lot of impact for what we think the next 3, 6, 9, 12 months look like. So as a quick recap, most of the global cases are being driven by three countries, the US, India, and Brazil, who have basically failed to contain COVID spread through a variety of limited/disparate policy choices.
It's very diplomatic. Basically, we messed it up, and so did the other countries.
So did Brazil. India messed it up-ish, but they also have a really lagging public health system that's like basically completely unable to cope with, even if they'd had a reasonable response, and have a sort of population density and host of factors that make them just really poorly suited for such a pandemic. And so that's not great, right? It's not great. But we thought, I think, as it was happening about a week ago, if you'd asked me, I would have said, yes, but we know what to do to contain the pandemic. And I still think we do, but I think it's worth sort of playing through the cases. We're seeing resurgence in a number of countries, in Europe generally, Spain in particular, Asia generally, Japan in particular, and Australia. with a new set of cases, which are all troubling because these are all countries that locked down pretty significantly. Japan with very active, very aggressive testing and contact tracing. And so the fact that we're seeing spreads, like sort of big blip ups really quickly there, is concerning. I think my takeaway from the research and from where we are on this is basically opening indoor stuff, and in particular bars where young people socialize, is just high risk. And that seems to be the driver in Spain with a lot of cases of young people. It seems to be the driver in Japan with a lot of cases of young people, from young people that then seem to transmit to older people. And I think that some of what's happening here is that in an effort to loosen up the lockdown and return to normalcy, there was a strong appetite to return to normalcy on social fronts to create sort of the feeling that you weren't constantly locked down. And that that seems to be just super high risk. I think countries that have managed to really eliminate it, like New Zealand, can afford to do that. And countries that are willing to just forego that entirely and have, you know, market economy for other things, but no bars and no sort of indoor social interactions, like Vietnam, seem to be doing okay. But that does say a lot for what we can facilitate in the US and Europe, especially as we move from summer to fall and winter, where outdoor activities become a lot less feasible, right? And so in-person offices, in-person meetings, travel, are all going to be really hard for the foreseeable future. And I think that that has significant sort of economic, social, and well-being impacts.
I mean, in some ways, this is a great time to be a comparative political scientist or a comparative public health person. You're getting all kinds of quasi-natural experiments in terms of policy changes and figuring out kind of what works. I mean, I'm at some level, obviously, any amount of restriction is going to lead to an increase of cases, right? And kind of yeah. the tightrope we're trying to walk is, what set of policies can we implement that would lessen the economic hardships on people who aren't able to go to work, or for, you know, the sort of suppression of economic activity, while accepting some increase of cases, but that keeps us below the ICU saturation threshold, right? Which is sort of what we're experiencing here in the United States in places like Texas and Florida. And so, you know, is it that you can open retail shops, but not bars, right? I mean, that's sort of like one, you know, sorts of thing. Right now, we have got a lot of experiments in the different professional leagues in the United States are doing different things with sports, in terms of, you've got like NBA bubbles, you've got Major League Baseball playing, but without crowds. And like, if you haven't seen the uncanny valley of the CGI crowds, it is super weird. I'm of the opinion they should have like little Muppets, like the Korean leagues did.
Oh my God.
In the stands. But I mean, I think it's, you know, we haven't quite cracked the code on this. And for me, the thing that sort of, I don't know why it sticks in my craw in such a way, is the number of places that Americans aren't allowed to travel right now.
Yeah.
Because our, you know, situation is so not under control. Other countries have basically, you know, implemented visa bans on us, and, you know, I can't blame them, but it's striking for people who, like us, who are used to traveling a lot, but also used to an American passport sort of being a key to wherever it is you want to go, unless you want to go to Iran or Cuba, then, you know, this is a quite different situation. So it does, I find that part sort of striking.
I'll just add a couple of points. And one, in looking at the data that you sent around, Radha, it's sort of notable to see the countries that have very good health infrastructure and tracking be ones that we're seeing surges in right now. And it makes you think that, like, it's not like the fact that we're seeing those means that, like, there are surges going on in other countries that are just not effectively as monitored as what we're seeing in like Germany or Switzerland. Second point being, I highly recommend, there's a Wired piece about the Taiwan digital minister. I was going to say digital defense. It's just digital minister, Audrey Tang, who is an incredible public servant, incredible woman, and what Taiwan has done in terms of digital monitoring and digital tracking of lots of different kinds of behaviors in order to keep the pandemic in check there. And Minister Tang overall is a fascinating person in terms of using multi-stakeholder crowdsourcing processes to generate new policies, which is something of what they did in this case, but that brings in people who care about privacy, who care about health, who care about like what is reasonable for children to be able to do in order to generate these policies in a way that's practical. But Taiwan's a different society in terms of it being so small, but it's still worth looking at. The last thing I'll mention is just sort of a fun aside. I am finished a project at CNES called the Future Digital Threats to Democracy, which is a futures looking project about how technological and political trends could be harmful to democracy overall. I'm writing a scenario based on that project, or working on a scenario with other people, looking at how it could become very attractive to monitor all kinds of behaviors in this current era that have very little to do with actual public health outcomes, but are interesting correlations that people start to make. And turning that data over to companies who can publish things like, hey, people who drink this beer have lower COVID rates, or hey, people who go to this pizza place always wear a mask, but also using those for enforcement so that you cannot participate in the economy where unless you are doing certain things like allowing credit card monitoring for contact tracing, or you can't buy something unless you're wearing a mask because you have to take a photo or things like that. All of those seem in certain societies plausible possible outcomes as we could become more frustrated with the inability to actually shut down effectively, particularly in the United States, where nobody seems to actually listen to a lot of what the mask guidance is.
I was like, I'm going to take your upside and make it a minor downer, which is, but with rays of sunshine, which is, I think we've seen, bear with me. We've seen in the U.S. really tremendous variation with minority communities in particular, hard hit by COVID, both infection, but also the consequence of infection. And that seems to be driven a lot by healthcare and healthcare access and the quality of care that different populations receive. I will say that the silver lining to this is in looking in the European data, when you see the rates of infection and then you see hospitalization, severe cases and death, you're seeing a really different tail on this than you saw, at least from the initial data we got in Europe before the initial set of lockdowns. And a lot of people are crediting that to just better healthcare. The healthcare industry has understood how to respond to this, some of the blood consequences, some of the oxygen consequences, and now have certain protocols for treating it. So I think, you know, we're all sort of holding our breath for vaccines, and that is an important dimension of this. But the therapeutic and treatment responses to this are important sort of from a human impact and quality of life. And we are seeing advancements there. So ray of sunshine-ish.
I'm looking forward to a future Bombshell episode where we talk about the international trade implications for vaccines and when, whether or not,
I have a lot of thoughts on IP in this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be very interesting.
One of the reasons we shut down the Chinese consulate in Houston was the spying on U.S. vaccine production.
Yes, the spying.
The spying. Hey, let's sell drones.
Yeah, so should we shift gears entirely? I mean, these are actually all White House mayhem-ish topics that we're now, clustering under keeping up foreign relations, but that's okay. So this week, the administration announced a new set of policies that actually had been under work for some time. And this actually gets back to another old debate topic, Radha, and you'll hear it because I still refer to the missile technology control regime as MITKR, because that's how I hear it in my head when I first learned it as a 16-year-old. But the missile technology control regime is a 35-year-old international agreement that largely regulates the sale of ballistic and cruise missiles. And it was determined early on in the development of various unmanned aerial vehicles or drones that they would also be covered by the MTCR regime. That's an interesting, there's kind of a fascinating, discussion about whether or not drones are in fact like missiles and should be controlled, as such. But there was an agreement that it would be. And so the countries that were party to the MTCR were subject to this restriction. Does anybody want to guess what country is not a member of the missile technology control regime?
Is it China?
It is China. And so China has sold drone technologies far and wide, armed, unarmed, high altitude, low, fast, slow, all of the above. And they sell them for cheap. And you know who loves cheap drones? Literally everybody. So yeah. They have a huge market share,
I love cheap drugs.
globally on this. And U.S. manufacturers, including my employer, for whom I very much do not speak, but U.S. drone manufacturers have been frustrated by their inability to export American-made, both surveillance and armed drones, to our allies. There's been some joint production on a couple of things, but for the most part, the Chinese and also the Israelis have actually been able to make incredible headway in the global market, and U.S. Manufacturers have been left out. So there's been sort of a relatively quiet, lobby for some time to adjust the MTCR rules and regulations. So as best I can understand, what happened this week is not so much that, right? There was not an agreement amongst the MTCR parties. There was instead a shift in classification by the United States about what would constitute a class one sale and have the presumption of denial for foreign sales. And that is any unmanned aircraft that is slower than 800 kilometers per hour would not be subject to the presumption of denial. So it still has to go through all of the usual export control restrictions and approvals from the State Department and whatnot, but it's not subject to a presumed denial under the missile technology control regime.
Yeah. So I accidentally mentioned this to my husband, who has many things to say. So one, I will spare you all the discussion on the reasons why we should not consider unmanned aerial crafts missiles, because size.
They come back. They're not missiles. I actually agree with, they're not missiles. I think it's ridiculous.
But I did learn a couple of things that I researched to validate and I think are interesting to note. So one is the agreement isn't like exactly legally binding, which is important. It is sort of an agreement amongst parties, but it means that there isn't per se standing that you can use to challenge this on either side, either as a company or for the government to sort of need to overcome to do this. And that's important because there's been a lot of sort of variations in how we interpret this. So for instance, a key craft that this impacts is the Reaper, which has a sizable payload and is of great interest to a number of Middle Eastern countries, including Saudi Arabia and UAE, who would likely or potentially use it to ill effect in Yemen, which has already had a huge civilian catastrophe. So that's true for the Reaper, but it is not technically binding on the Predators, even armed Predators. But historically, we had not sold the Predators under the same sort of logic with the presumption of denial. And that was basically a decision, a policy decision, not a legally binding agreement. And so it's important here, I think, to recognize the extent to which sort of policy preferences here from the administration come into play, part A. Part B, the role that this sort of weird China policy that we talked about in the beginning impacts a number of these discussions in which they seem to be a driver in sort of competing with China without really balancing considerations of some of the other impacts, including, for instance, Yemen, but also sort of trade with allies. And three, the extent to which if this were to be reversed in some future administration or the sort of variability in this interpretation actually is problematic, because there is not a rule or a law that allows companies and allows a sort of global market to understand it. And so creating a lot of uncertainty under these policy driven agreements is actually a complicated thing in and of itself, just on two particular fronts, and then I'll stop, which is one on this one, just on what's going to be covered by it, what's not, and how that should affect investments. But two, on whether this type of agreement, which we have had, this is not the only version of, whether these types of agreements among sort of allied parties are really enough to generate control regimes. And if they're not, then what do we do with the other ones, right? And so I think that uncertainty matters and is kind of under-discussed in the specifics.
Yeah, I mean, what we realistically need, I think is what you're getting at, a final point you're getting at, Radha, is a control regime or arms control agreement around drones as a separate concept. There are parties that are like, drones are bad and evil, and we don't want them to be used at all, so let us not actually allow them to be used in any form. Also, we want to buy them. We want to buy lots of them, and we want to use them in various places. So and this is where you end up having some of our allies speak out of both sides of their mouths in terms of wanting pretty significant regulation of these platforms, while also very much being happy that they exist and very much being happy to use them in other capacities. And they have different stakeholders in their governments who are fighting and advocating for both.
All of which is to say, this is actually a pretty tough environment to imagine new international agreements or productive U.S.-led negotiations to existing international agreements. And that's why, I mean, so the other existing MTCR stakeholders are a little frustrated that we've kind of unilaterally pursued this change in interpretation, as opposed to getting it approved by the other members. So, but interesting for the defense industry, and will be interesting to see, you know, how that's, you know, applied and effectively implemented. So, on a similar-ish note, shall we shift to White House mayhem and talk about our favorite, the National Defense Authorization Act?
I love it.
So we have one. And it, I mean, I don't know, maybe the NDAA always passes this early, but it seems like very early in the cycle for the NDAA to be passed.
Well, I mean, to be clear, it hasn't passed. It's the Senate and the House have passed.
It's come out of Congress, though. Yes.
Right.
Well, with really strong votes, right?
So that part is a little odd, the very strong votes. It has passed for the past 59 years straight. So, you know, people are kind of in the like, yes, let's get the hell out of Dodge. I think what is slightly different in this cycle, Aaron, is people like to pass these sorts of bills earlier so they can go home and campaign on them and also not closer to the election have any sort of controversial things come up like, oh, Confederate bases, which would be awkward to talk about in October for some parties as opposed to July.
So both the House and the Senate have now passed the NDAA, and both have passed them with sizable majorities that are considered veto-proof, which is important because, as Lauren mentions, the president has threatened to veto any bill that requires the Department of Defense to rename Confederate bases. And we talked about this, you know, some time ago. There are 10-plus bases that are named after Confederate officers and that many folks would like to see renamed on account of the Confederacy lost the war and a bunch of traitors. But there's actually a bunch of other stuff in the NDAA, which I greatly enjoyed reading about. And I have to say that I sort of love the NDAA for its ability to have like random pet projects. So there's a variety of things, including the Pacific Defense Initiative, like exactly how many F-35s and submarines we're going to buy. But my favorite thing that's potentially in the NDAA is an amendment requiring the Space Force to use Navy ranks. And I just, like, that is, like, so in the weeds and potentially petty that I love it so much.
This is still a topic of conversation in my house.
I believe it is. I don't doubt that for a second.
Anyway, yeah. Different science fiction things and who uses which ranks. It's a thing. Yeah.
Of course, the Space Force is part of the Department of the Air Force, and that would be a little surprising.
Marine is part of the Department of Navy.
But does not use naval ranks. So there
does
is
not,
some precedent.
Exactly. So there is precedent.
It'd be fascinating.
Oh, then we also have places like Battlestar Galactica where they seem to do both.
That's right.
Major Tie.
But Admiral Adama.
Colonel Tie.
So confusing.
The two things that I think are interesting about the, or I guess one thing that's interesting about this NDAA is that there was basically in that, I would, how do I say this politely? House Democrats, particularly House Democrats who want to cut the defense budget, are not super great at figuring out how to do that within their own processes. They're much better at it in terms of thinking of themselves as a minority party who just offers up really cool amendments late in the game when the whole House has to debate them, which is when they're more likely to get adopted in some cases. They're not as good as doing it from within their own markup process wherein they might say like, hey, we really want to cut the defense budget by like 10%. They haven't really managed to get a super ton of stuff through like that. They are more effective at doing it in a big kind of public kind of way that gets lots of media attention.
Which happened again this cycle. There were amendments in both houses for a 10% reduction in the top line, and those both failed. So overall, the NDAA looks to authorize a defense budget of $740 billion with the B dollars. And we'll see kind of what the appropriators actually put that against when we get to the budget bill itself.
And two just personnel points, which is one, like always, the NDAA contains a pay raise for service members, which is handy, but particularly relevant in the context of the current economic conditions and lagging recruitment numbers. But second, I think we'd be a little remiss if we didn't talk about some of the sexual harassment amendments that Jackie Speier put forward related to the death and discovery of body of Vanessa Guillen, who had reported to her family that she was being sexually harassed. And in follow-on investigation, a number of women in the same unit and on the same base reported similar experiences to try to deal with the ongoing issue of sexual harassment and sexual assault in the military writ large on a number of bases, as well as at the service academies. So this is sort of moving away from the military justice initiative pushed by Senator Gillibrand that she sort of continues to support and didn't get into this NDAs and past NDAs, but really does talk about creating sort of parallel procedures for sexual harassment, not just unwanted sexual contact, that allows sort of anonymous reporting, attempts to identify serial offenders who may be creating hostile climates, as well as attempts to incorporate some of the best practices on sexual harassment and behavior in the service academy. So some of those amendments didn't quite make it in. I think there's discussion on whether we'll see some movement on that in conference as they reconcile the House and Senate bills. And I think it's worthwhile to keep in mind, especially given that we have not seen a lot of movement on a number of the sexual assault and sexual harassment initiatives that were started in the last administration. So it would be good to see some progress here.
I believe we would like to now discuss the protests.
Lauren, I have a question for you. How do we feel about people attending these protests in uniform?
So you mean like not the fact that CBP is wearing uniforms, but...
I want to come to the youth. I want to like juxtapose these two discussions. So the two things I have are civil norms and protesters in uniforms and domestic law enforcement organizations in military uniforms. And I want to talk about both and then talk about the two issues together.
Okay, I think this is a really fascinating question. And norms, the norm that people have been talking about at length is whether or not men and women who are currently serving or previously served should be allowed to go to political protests while wearing a uniform.
Political, not partisan.
Yeah. With which they are ostensibly representing their service in some form. So the best conversation I've seen on this that I'm intrigued on and would like to follow more is whether or not the norm that we really care about in this is as big a deal in this instance. If it's actually more important for our men and women in uniform to be able to express support for Black Lives Matter movement or the various protests that are going right now versus saying to them, like, you just can't wear your uniform to a protest overall. And like that is actually a more important message that we should be caring about. We should be permitting it in some way. Now, most people are like, no, we just can't. Making exceptions to that is stupid because then you would have all kinds of things that you would have to worry about policies for. But I'm attracted to that conversation about whether or not we should be caring about that sort of political use of the uniform in some form.
Well, I think that the issue is there for me is that we're not content neutral on that space, right? So if you had people in uniform at the Charlottesville protest, for example, we would consider that to be highly inappropriate. So, I guess I'm sympathetic to not allowing service members wearing their uniforms at protests, but still they are free in their private person to go. They're there as private citizens. That's still problematic for a lot of folks, and I think would be interesting to explore. But I do think that there's a lot. It's this question that we've addressed on the CivMil side for several years now, right? Which is that we are so far past the norm on so many issues. Do we continue to hold the line? Is there some breaking case of glass on a last couple sets, or do we recognize that we are so far beyond the pale of the normal that we actually should allow people to act in abnormal ways in order to demonstrate how past the line we are?
And can I just put a finer point on that question? And I'd be interested in both of your responses, which is, does your response to that change when you feel like the state is misusing military uniforms to create the perception of military use of force on domestic political protests in the context of domestic law enforcement? Does that sort of change the extent to which we think we're in a break glass in the case of emergency, the extent to which these norms should be preserved? Like, how does the fact that we have essentially domestic law enforcement units in unmarked, unnamed, military-esque uniforms play into our feeling that individuals in the military, either currently or formerly serving, should wear uniforms?
So, Radha, it's interesting. So that is actually not the factor that had persuaded me that like we should have treated this a bit differently, though I think that is definitely worth considering. We can talk about it. The factor that persuaded me was the tacit and some often active endorsement of, let's say, the Confederate flag in the context of our U.S. military, allowing it to be displayed, happily encouraging it to be endorsed, using it as a sort of good old boys network within which we say that, like, this, if you don't support this, then you're probably not one of the in crowd within this part of the military. And to the degree to which, I mean, with Confederate bases named after traitors, like, how much have we been endorsing a white supremacist, right-wing network within our own U.S. military without having any regulations to hold that back at all. If you had tried to fly a Black Lives Matter flag on an Army base, would you have been punished a few years ago? Probably. Or at least maybe not punished, but at least like been asked to take it down in some form. So to me, that like it starts to become a question of like, how much are members of the U.S. military trying to push back against what has been a tacit expression of white supremacist, right-wing politics within their military, and trying to push back against that in ways that they maybe are not the most effective, but like are ways that they know how to do so. But I think your other question about like the whether or not when the state is co-opting military branding, that's also a good one.
I mean, and also it's a really good, this is the only defense I've ever seen for the Marines copywriting their MARPAT camouflage, which is to keep everyone else from using it as well. So, you know, which is an interesting sort of challenge.
So I'm not a civ mil expert, and so this is sort of not my area, but I am persuaded, sort of, I find persuadable arguments on both dimensions of this. I think for me, the open question here is when the state is sort of co-opting military uniforms for something that seems contrary to the oath and sort of purpose of the military, whether reclaiming that by the military in the same way that sort of like opposition to unlawful orders and sort of a range of sort of in-uniform activities are appropriate. Like, when does that happen? When the state is issuing unlawful actions by people in uniforms that look like what you're doing, when does the military stand up and say, that's not the military, that is unlawful, that is unconstitutional, we're here to say no?
So, I mean, to me, the issue, I don't, there's so many dimensions to this, because like it's hard to talk about CBP wearing military uniforms as a civil person when at the end of the day, like I recognize that they're CBP people, but 99% of the Americans don't. So to me, the CBP is using uniforms not in order to co-opt the military image, but in order to intimidate. They're using it to scare people. They're using it to frighten them into no longer participating in this. So they're caring less about the fact that they're co-opting that image and more just about like making people want to go home. So, but to me, it would be more appropriate for Secretary Esper, which he has theoretically done, pushing back on this publicly and regularly. Of course, the way that Esper pushes back on things is like he has somebody leak it to a newspaper as opposed to actually push back on it in any way. That's could be a useful response if they found that the civilian representation was not adequately pushing back for them. I don't really have evidence of that yet.
But I guess, like, to put that in a different way, that doesn't allow protesters to know and feel that, right? Like, that's great. That's like a totally legitimate, like in DC sort of air quotes blob response. But like when I'm a protester in Portland and I see a bunch of guys that look to me like the Army there, you know, unless there's someone on my side who I can visually identify and say like, hey, he's also in the Army and he's saying like, these guys are violating their oath. And like, this isn't the Army and this isn't what they're doing. So I don't know how to balance the need for those things in my mind in sort of a world in which we believe that like peaceful protests are a legitimate activity and unlawful, unwarranted use of force on them is unconstitutional and that something that would be oath violating.
I mean, I think what's interesting is that the perception then is that it damages the reputation of the military or damages the perception of the military. I think that these guys could all just be in like 5'11s and some other tactical, you know, outfit, right? Which is what like a lot of, you know, police SWAT teams wore for years, right? As opposed to any sort of digicam or, you know, something that matched the armed services. Somebody like made a joke about we should just issue them all the Navy digital camouflage because no one's intimidated by that. And I thought that was hilarious, to be honest. But I, you know, the broader issue, and I think we probably would agree, you know, about this, is that there is a set of essentially paramilitary forces that are accountable not to the military chain of command and not under the UCMJ, but instead through the Department of Justice. And they're basically, because we have a particular attorney general being used as the personal protection force for the president of the United States. And so that is a different set of concerns and a different set of remedies than the uniforms they're wearing and whether we should have, you know, folks wearing parallel uniforms on the protester side. I mean, I guess I would be in favor. Everybody should be wearing their like, you know, service PT uniform or wear your service academy sweatshirt if you're trying, yeah, trying to sort of reclaim some of that authority. But
I really don't have a set position on that, but I think we can all agree. And the reason why there's opposition to it is that that is different. that creates a different perception, that mm-hmm. establishes a different level of authority. Like, that is different. So you can wear your Navy sweatshirt and you can wear your 8005 super ugly, by the way, Navy, get better hats, submarine, whatever unit you are on, hats. That is not the same as showing up in your uniform, and you know it. And that's why we're concerned about it, but it's also why it's more powerful. Right. And so I think, like, we have to be honest about that trade-off. And the trade-off that we are essentially saying, that there is disproportionate authority and control by the state, even when acting outside of the constitutional legal authorities of the state, to control the use of that uniform in repressing constitutionally protected activities, and that that is the thing we care about protecting.
I mean, like, I don't think that's why they ban uniforms. That's not why they ban uniforms.
Yeah, they ban uniforms because we don't want the state, we don't want the military engaged in political activity. My point is that there's breaking the rules on both sides here, right? And we're protecting one of the norms of the sides.
Yes, but there's no rules against others wearing the uniform.
Okay, fine. I think that's probably problematic.
In yes,
and
we're, right?
And it ain't problematic. There's just no rules about it.
I guess my question is the de facto impact of that,
right,
versus the legal or, you know, norm protecting restrictions on this, are ones that I just think are worth especially examining in the context of which, in which the thing that we are fighting is the continued state oppression against a minority.
Sure. On the other hand, I mean, and I'm, you know, this is a fraught, you know, topic in many ways, obviously, but I'm also not, the protesters are not, you know, legally sanctioned, you know, that's not legally sanctioned army activity. That's not an approved deployment. And I wouldn't want the public to be confused about the role of the armed forces in any sort of American domestic disturbance. And so I agree with you, Radha, that we have the de facto rules, right, allow for the perception of these, you know, other state actors to be perceived as military. And that's quite harmful and flawed. But I don't think the remedy to that is allowing other people there on their own recognizance to be able to wear their uniform. I mean, I could actually, like, if you want to show up in dress blues, right, to one of these protests, like, I'm fascinated by that imagery,
oh,
right? Because that's not a battle uniform,
yeah,
right?
That's interesting. That's a really interesting point.
You know, so but other people showing up in camis, that is not going to improve the situation from my perspective.
No, that's just
going to
make it more confusing.
Yeah.
At this point, like, we can't even enforce, like, not arresting journalists, like, because they, quote unquote, can't tell who they are. So having more people show up in comparable uniforms is just going to generate confusion.
This is not where I thought this conversation was going to go. So that's exciting and very interesting for look, it's almost a disagreement on Bombshell. Like, we even talked about drones without disagreeing today, Radha, which is shocking to me. So.
I know, guys. I love drones.
I know
we
you
didn't
do.
We didn't talk about using them.
All right. So should we talk a little pop culture? We've all had lots of time. You know, I got to watch a lot of Netflix while sitting in a, you know, bedroom at my parents' house recuperating, which is where I binged The Babysitter's Club, which I'm sure many of us have watched. And if you have not, and if you have,
I just started it. It's great.
It's delightful. It is pure. It's better than cotton candy. It's like a strawberry shortcake. It's just, like, perfectly delightful for the summer.
But guys, I'm so excited because for the first time ever, I feel like a thing that I suggested was a thing that everyone read, and now we can all talk about it.
Yeah.
What was the thing, Radha?
It's The Guinevere Deception, because as folks may recall from many episodes ago, I had loosely mentioned this idea of Camelot related to the musical, not the Arthurian legends, in at work, and then went deep down the rabbit hole of female-led literature in Arthurian legends, culminating in The Guinevere Deception, which I believe we have now all read.
We have all read. And so, spoiler alert, if you don't want to hear the spoilers, because we're going to spoil things here, because that's how, I mean, Lauren probably looked them up before she even read it. So, I mean, it's just...
Kind of, yeah.
Kind of not, but I will say that, like, just for context, I read this after reading first in detail a number of, like, summaries on Arthurian legends online, and then this Rosalind Miles series on Guinevere and Arthur, which is sort of like a Guinevere-led, but, like, Guinevere is kind of lame in it, so it is what it is.
Guinevere's always lame. That's what's that's always the problem.
And then ended up here. So I was really deep in Arthurian legends when I got here, so I have a lot of
So what's fascinating to me is to try to juxtapose. I mean, I grew up on the Mists of Avalon, right? Like, I read that in high school and I've read it several times. And then I read all the other Marion Zimmer Bradley books. And then it also turns out that Marion Zimmer Bradley herself is incredibly problematic and abusive. And so that's weird to like have to wrap your brain around. But, you know, she centers, you know, it's a total rework of the Arthurian legend, and Sun centers more of like the Celtic traditions, and in particular, Morgaine or Morgan Le Fay and Vivien, the Lady of the Lake. So I, you know, was reading The Guinevere Deception and kept, I mean, obviously we're all still trying to figure out like who, this is the spoiler alert, who is Guinevere? Right. Yeah. And I don't have, like, I was like going through my mental cast of characters of who she could be. But apparently I thought she was going to be Morgan Le Fay, but she's not. So I still have no idea like who she is.
And I think it's super interesting, this like role that Merlin plays in the like creation of the Gwen. In some sense, she's like an unreliable narrator. That's not quite the right, but because she's like unreliable to herself, and right, she has like right, implanted memories. And like, so like trying to even figure out who, her journey of trying to figure out who she is in the context of all of this like mental intrusion is super interesting.
I did figure out the Patchwork Knight. I assume you did too, yeah. Lauren. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
like, Patchwork Knight. And I'll be intrigued to see in the next book, like, do they go down the path of Lancelot Guinevere romance?
Mm-hmm.
There doesn't seem anything limiting to that, except for the fact that we already have Arthur Guinevere kind of romance, and then Guinevere Mordred kind of romance.
Another spoiler alert, Mordred's a bad guy. Who knew? Only anybody who'd ever read an Arthurian legend before. So, right. I mean, like that, but I was still slightly surprised at that turn. I mean, it is a funny thing, you know, so Rada, you mentioned Camelot the Musical. Camelot the Musical really is about a love triangle, right? And, and one of the things that some versions of the Arthurian legend explore is the love amongst the men in the round table. And it's not always romantic love, although sometimes it is, but it is this love that is incredibly binding. And so usually that love triangle is that, you know, like Guinevere is in love with both of the men. And then, you know, Arthur and Lancelot are bound together in this sort of brotherly or, you know, almost like courtly love in a certain sort of way. And so the way that this story has that set up is that there could still be some sort of love triangle, but it's set up differently. Also, the way that they have written Lancelot, it very much reminded me of Brienne from Game of Thrones.
Oh, totally. It's 100% Brienne.
You know, very sort of, I don't know, fitful there. So we'll see. I mean, there's so much like flip-flopping almost for effect that I don't know if it's going to be able to carry it off. I'll be interested to see what the sequel sort of looks like, but it's been a long time since I've read much Arthurian legend. So Rada, we thank you for your introduction of this new entry to the list. So,
however, warning, I thought that the sequel was already out and it's not.
It's not. I know. I'm very unhappy because I was ready to binge that in another, you know, pool reading on the weekend. So Rada, we are also both watching the Indian matchmaking show on Netflix.
Oh my God. It's so addictive and like just so terrible. It's like, you know, some like Indian American subculture meets like the Real Housewives meets Bachelor. And it's like so amazing that Rhonda Plum and Rada Iyengar both really appreciate it.
I also binged the first season of Bosch, which is this detective noir series on Amazon Prime. That's actually like, if you like detective shows and you're sort of, it's not quite the genius, difficult detective, which I have no patience for any longer. He's not a genius, but it's definitely hits all of the standard like broken detective tropes, and it's set in kind of modern LA. But is quite watchable. So, you know, there's sort of that. My mother sent me an email this morning highlighting several new entries for Masterpiece PBS for this fall, which she's very excited about. So we'll dig into that and see, you know, what comes. It means that it'll all be, you know, basically British series that she'll need to have the subtitles on for, but it should be great for everyone. So.
Excellent.
Any other pop culture? Any other hot topics? It's so good to see you, and so good for us all to be back. And we'll be with everyone another couple weeks.